and welcome to the David Crib podcast. My name is Brett Lawton, and today I'm very excited to be joined by Helena Uambembe, who recently collaborated with the David Crib workshop on a body of works relating to artistic practice. So I think today is quite an exciting opportunity to get to know Helena a bit more, and we look forward to hearing what you have to say. So welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm super excited.
I think maybe an awesome place to start would be if you could give us a quick overview of who you are, what your artistic practice is about, and yeah, let our audience get to know you a bit.
So I'm Helena Uambembe. I'm an artist. I like to think so. I work between Joburg and Pretoria. I studied at Tshwane University of Technology. I have a BTEC in Fine and Applied Arts. I work in various mediums or across disciplines, from printmaking to textile art, performance, photography, and video work. I work in so many mediums or in so many disciplines because I feel like whatever story I'm trying to tell or message I'm trying to convey, one medium won't be able to do it. So I like to like be flexible and not be confined to one sort of making. But I think I always turn towards printmaking. It's my first love. My work deals with my personal history and the history of the 3-2 Battalion and my Angolan heritage. So it's always weird where I have to like try and sum up the history of 3-2 that kind of makes up who I am. And kind of, in a sense, led to my existence. Had my father not joined the military, he would have not met my mom and I would have not existed. So 3-2 Battalion was a military unit started 1975-76, made up of mainly Black Angolan soldiers fighting for the South African apartheid government at the time, who were like involved in a lot of, I mean, in like what they called the border wars. So from Namibia, or resisting the Namibian independence movement, and to their involvement in Angola, kind of like resisting communism because South Africa's borders had to be protected, which is, I find bizarre, because like, how do you fight an idea? That's where the history starts. And the document, I think I look also at the documentation of it, question the history itself, because like what is written, what most people turn to is kind of like the writings of Nogia, Piet Nogia, by the way, and Jan Breitenbach. And they kind of like sideline the black soldiers and their families. But I think it's not only a focus on the military, because the history is so complex. The soldiers moved with their families. So you get where they were staying, where the base was in Buffalo. They made room for their families. They even went as far as to like pushing single soldiers to go find wives. So it was not just like soldiers fighting and then all of you go home afterwards. It was like home was the military, because the families that made up home were part of it. So it's just like questioning it, but also telling personal stories, looking at memory, collective amnesia, personal stories that like, besides the military, going back to like people's homes, going back to people's origins, what they left behind and what they have gained. As much as there was trauma, there was also like love stories, the moments of happiness and joy. And I really try and look into it. And it's like, it's an ongoing research project that I present through art.
No, that's fantastic. I mean, it is a very hard history to sum up. It's an ongoing inquiry, and there's so many stories and layers to something like that. And it's a very particular history too. But at the same time, you're bringing in a lot of your personal stories and other people's personal stories too. How did that kind of interest come about? Is that just your interest in the archive? Is that your interest in your family history?
I think it's interest in my family history, because there is, again, displacement and leaving behind of home identities, performing identities, regaining identities, or you know, making up new identities, which is kind of summed up in performing identity. So I think I had this interest in finding who I am, and in doing so, I had to kind of dig into their history, and also just making sense of me, this person who identifies as Angolan, who performs Angolanness and performs Angola, ended up in South Africa, like a whole community, actually not just me, but a whole community. And I think it's a thing that always goes through my mind, thinking about Pomfret, which is where I was born and where I lived for about 7 years. And then kept on going back to it for school holidays. So to kind of paint a picture, if you think of the borders of South Africa to do it, like in conjunction of Namibia, it's literally where Pomfret is, like on the map, that little swoop thingy. It's on the edge of the Kalahari. If people know Freiburg, which people don't know Freiburg, it's like 200 plus kilometers away. When you drive there, it's like a tar road. And then there comes to a point where the tar road ends and it's just gravel. For hours, like, and obviously it makes the trip longer because now you have to drive slow because you don't want rocks to hit your car. And then you get to the entrance of Pomfret. Pomfret had one main entrance and then another side entrance, which was not used by anyone, especially when the military is active. And you get there, it says, "Welcome to Pomfret." It's a big gate. So the unit was disbanded in 93. And the military pulled out in 2000. When you get in, you have to sign in, declare what you're doing here. And even when you leave as well. But you have to come back, especially if you're a native there. For me, that just did not make sense. And we were in South Africa, you know, and we called ourselves Angolanos. And there was like this, them and us and them, inside South Africa, but also in terms of interaction with Angola, and it still is a thing right now. Like there's us and them and us, here but not there, there but not here. And it's words I like playing around with in my work as well and in my thinking. So like that is Pomfret. That is like Pomfret, this weird area. And the population there, even if you Google it, the language most spoken is Portuguese. Which is, again, a colonial language. How do I make sense of that? Because it's crazy. It's just crazy thinking about it. Even now, as I'm telling you this, it's these heritages of colonial past, inheritance of apartheid, where things didn't make sense and still don't make sense now. We have to live with the ramification of the histories that were being made. So it's a whole trying to make sense of everything.
Yeah. So your curiosity is more about trying to make sense of how these histories impact the present moment and identities.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks.
And how long have you been living in South Africa for?
So I was born in South Africa and the unit came in 1990, like between 1989 and 1990, so it's like almost 30 years plus. So when Namibia got independence, obviously the unit was a part of the South African military. They had South African uniform, they had South African identity, they were the responsibility of the South African government. So a few people stayed behind in Namibia and most people moved to Pomfret. That's how it kind of began. Identity is like also a thing that I try and make sense of, as I explained, because it's like being born in Pomfret, it's so separated. I don't know. I still question my identities. Both my parents are Angolan, but I was born in South Africa. I'm referred to like, oh, but you're actually Angolan. And some people were like, but yeah, you're actually South African, you know? But right now I am neither here nor there.
It's one of those complexities, I suppose, and that's what your practice is constantly inquiring into, right?
Yeah.
Can I ask what like kind of resources do you use to find out information?
So it's usually through oral storytelling and interviews. So especially, I still have an archive from 2008 where my collective partner and I, Teresa Firmino, got funding from the Goethe Institute. And we traveled to Pomfret, Zeerust, here in Pretoria, and Oskraal, which are like areas that have a large presence or large bases of Angolan people from Pomfret. We got to interview them and like take photos and hear stories, which was like amazing. There were like people who wanted to speak to us and people who just like were like, no. And that was also interesting, especially the woman kind of had this reluctance to talk. Mm. The men were like, yeah, we'll talk. And we wanted to like really get the woman's story, but they were just silent. I remember we organized with one aunt and she agreed, she came and she just, you know, kept quiet. And that silence was so heavy.
Mm.
It was so heavy and it said so much versus if she had told a story. In family gatherings, we sit and we tell stories and those stories come up, you know, those personal stories come up. I also draw on my own personal memory, you know, my time in Pomfret and just my interaction with the community. I think right now there are things I'm picking up that I wouldn't have picked up way back then. I think now I'm more aware because obviously there are things I would like to get out.
And how long have you been practicing as an artist, and has your understanding or interest in this story or archive changed from then till now?
So the research started in 2016. So I was making work before then, but it wasn't what I'm doing now. I was more focused on like the female body and female identity, and it like completely changed. And I always had an interest in talking about my history, but I didn't know how. When Teresa and I met my collective partner, the collective is called Kutala Chobetu, and we met and started talking. And I, in our community, we are the only two who studied visual arts and pursued it as a career. So the research process and the making started in 2016 and it's going on till now. And I think it changed. So it started off with mainly performance, and we told stories. We wrote a lot of stories that we ended up making myths out of in a very sensitive manner. And we started writing. So like one story was The Crocodile Lover, which we performed in 2016 at Goodman Gallery, Cape Town, which is a story about a woman who is dreaming of her lover, and her lover is a soldier who has to find a partner, but he's actually a crocodile who spoke to the moon and the moon granted him a wish to turn into a man so he can find a woman lover because he was in love. And then he only had one night to kind of make, to seal the deal. Midnight came, he turned back into a crocodile, and the woman he was with like screamed that, oh my God, this monster, only for her to wake up and realize that she is stuck in this reality. Yeah, so it was like writing stories like that, making it myth, making it poetic, looking into African storytelling, folklore. So that was fun. And now I think we've really developed. We haven't performed in a long time. I haven't performed in almost a year now. The work took on a form of textile. Before that, I was still doing printmaking, but not how I did it at David Crit Workshop. I think I just love how the prints came out, and I got to see a new a new way of seeing my work. So yeah, the work has really evolved from how it started.
So that story that you've told now, it also uses a lot of symbolism. You mentioned myth and stuff. And I recognize in your images that you've produced at the Devakrit workshop, there's actually quite a bit of symbolism in those as well, like the repetition of motifs, the buffalo heads, those kinds of things.
Yeah, I never thought about it that way, but it actually does. I think they tell a story or they tie everything together. So yeah, the buffalo took on this meaning of death and violence. But I think now I'm more looking at it in terms of African beliefs and how masks are used representatives of deities. And I think in that there's life and death. And I think it's something that's going to develop the use of the buffalo, which I had so much fun. They were just, I think I've been overthinking, but then once I got into the studio and just the atmosphere of the studio allowed me to kind of like easily create them. I think the buffalo is something I'm going to use for a long time. Buffalo is such a majestic animal. They're big, they're beautiful, they are so stubborn. They're able to fight off lions. They're the only ones who are able to, like, maybe I'm wrong, but to actually kill a lion or to fight it off. And I love that about them. I love the horn. And it's something I'm gonna keep using it for a long time. So it's like things like that, what the buffalo means. And also, like, I think the buffalo, for me, I look at, like, South African culture, especially Africana culture, and the love of buffaloes and bulls. I find that fascinating, especially with males, like, because the buffalo is so strong, there's this attachment to it with, like, white men and the buffaloes. And actually, the person who designed the insignia of 3-2 was a male, you know, and the flag. And they decided that we're going to use the buffalo. That military green is something we tried to bring in the prints, and I use a lot in the textile. It just reminds me a lot of the military aspect, the tents that I grew up seeing, the tents that were used for funerals. So it's like things like that, yeah, that fascinate me.
And that use of material, I mean, you bring in some elements that aren't, so it's not just paper and print, you also bring in these like collage elements to a certain degree, which is quite nice.
So for me, collaging is something that I love doing and I've always been doing. And I think because it works with the history, the whole cut and paste, cutting people out of their home and pacing them into a new region. It's just like, it's a form of collaging. I think South Africa is like a one big collage because it's a cut and paste of people and things from all parts of the world, all parts of Africa. For example, like the images that I use for the series, Nell's Archive, I actually got it from Commander Nell, who is a retired soldier. He was the officer in command of 3-2 between 77, 78, somewhere there, and like was in and out. He kind of curated the images. We interviewed him, Teresa and I interviewed him in 2016. We come into his house. He's like, yeah, I can give you pictures if you guys want. And he's like really old. And you know how old people are with computers. You know, the one finger type. So I offered to help him. And he's like, no, don't touch my computer. And he kind of like, I can't give you all the images. So he's like very selective of which images he gave. Like he gave images of him, like with the community, things like when the school was opened, posing with a trophy. So it's like, it was very reflective of how he saw himself in this very heroic light. And he even spoke about it. So he had a very white savior complex, which is actually very problematic.
It's almost that microcosm of what's happened with the history books in general. I mean, it's told by people who see themselves as the heroes of the story. So obviously it's going to be curated in a very particular way and tell a very particular story.
Exactly. So I think with the print and the bringing in of like the motifs of the soldiers, the stitching used, the text, was me interrupting that storyline that he gave himself and bringing in other elements and other stories that happened. Because as much as he would tell something, other people remember it a whole different way. Interrupting those images, you know, the collaging, the drawing, was a way of including the other stories.
That is kind of, I suppose, the challenge and why you're constantly working on something like this, is because you've got to try and tell a story and understand a story at the same time and unpack other people's story and create your own story. It's complicated, but it's an amazing journey that you're on, and it's so exciting that you're creating artworks that can welcome people into that story as well, inviting them to ask questions about the pictures, about the people, about the history. I know that you mentioned text at one point as well. You spoke about the words that you use. You like to play around with words like then and now and binary oppositions in a certain way.
I think it goes to my love of reading and my love of text, because I think as much as I'm a visual person, we use language quite a lot. My understanding of language is that it's a construction, and it informs. So the words we use now kind of informs the times we're living in. One of the popular words that we have is pandemic, COVID, corona. And those are things that inform what is happening now. Historically, I'm multilingual. I speak Portuguese, English. Grew up in Afrikaans towns like Potchefstroom. So there is that. I'm not good at Afrikaans, but I understand that. I went to an Afrikaans high school. I lived in the Northwest, which is predominantly Tswana, in Pretoria, Sotho. So there is that, the mixture of languages that I like to bring in. My parents are Umbundu. You know, they spoke Umbundu, and I listen to Umbundu music till today. And they are just like words that make sense for the work and that I like to bring in, even in my research process. So a lot of the text I use is text that I found in like notebooks, artist books, like random notes. I always make notes. Even if it's on a piece of paper, I try and keep it. I don't want to throw it away because it may come in handy someday, or I may think of that thing. So the texts were from there. The research on some of the text was from there. Translation to Umbundu, which is also a way of trying to preserve a language. Africa is so big. It has a lot of languages. And then you go to Google, you type your name, and your name is an error. Like, me writing text in Umbundu is kind of a way of archiving it. The language is legitimate. I don't know. I would like to have that option to be able to translate a word on Google Translate or on the internet. Mm. So someone out there, please make it happen. It would be amazing.
Well, it's amazing that you're bringing it into your practice. And I mean, as I said, it's something that's so cool because it invites people to ask more questions. So, you know, perhaps having that language incorporated into your artworks will get enough people to be curious to let it be brought into the more contemporary scene, perhaps. Using text and all these variety of mediums that you've used, and then coming through to the David Cook workshop, I mean, you have spoken about being in the studio already. How did you find the start and the experience of the creative process, working collaboratively and working in a print workshop?
It was amazing. I loved every second of it. I think at first I was like very reserved and a bit nervous because like these amazing technicians who make printmaking the magic that it is. And there I am. I have a bit of experience in printmaking. I have knowledge of it, but I don't think I could. I'm not technically advanced as they are. But I think it was such a free space. I'm a person who works with music. If there are people around me, I want to engage with them and talk to them. And they allowed me to do that. I'm not a person like who goes, sits in the corner and works. There's a lot of movement, a lot of music, a lot of noise happening as I work, even in my own space. And they allowed me to be part of that space, engage with all of them, all the people in the space. So that was like fascinating, that the fact that I could like play, you know, Ombudu music and they would listen. They were open to listening to it and they would ask questions about it, which really made the process much more easy, you know, like, and the work, I think, flowed as it came. I don't think there was a moment where I felt stuck. It happens to me quite a lot where I feel stuck in the work and I just want to like abandon it. I think that's the beauty of the space where they allow an artist to be an artist. Like Roxy was like, no, sit, we can do it for you. And I'm like, but I'm a printmaker, you know, I want to get in the ink, I want to roll. And she allowed that me to be part of the making process, the printing process, which was just beautiful. And I think that's why the work came out as they did, you know, and listening to different experiences and different advices from all of them was amazing. You guys have an amazing printing team. Definitely want to come back and work with you guys again.
That's awesome. That's what we want to hear, because we enjoyed having you as well, of course. And the images that have come out of it are very exciting, and we can't wait to start showing people and telling them all about it and sharing this information as well. Just out of curiosity, has like the printmaking experience that you've had at the workshop influenced the way that you're working now, like going forward in any way?
Definitely. I think definitely. What I enjoyed at the workshop, and one thing that was encouraged was the drawing aspect, which comes out a lot in the series that I did with a workshop. And I went to a very technical university that I loved drawing. And then after I left, I was like, I don't think I can draw, you know, and what is drawing anyway? And it's coming back to in the current works that I'm doing, thinking out of the box, the collaging, the shinkale, which I just love, is coming into the current work.
Awesome. That's good news. Yeah. Is there anything else that you want to tell us about or mention that you haven't mentioned yet?
Follow us on Instagram, buy art, support artists, support women artists.
Well, thank you. Helena, for joining me today. It's been fantastic speaking to you and hearing more about your artistic practice and your process and the research and everything that you do. It's very important work. And thank you for joining us at the workshop. We also can't wait to share all these images with people.
Thank you so much, Britt.